The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I hope that the first week of the new school year has started off well for you. We're going to begin tonight by talking about aging and improving the care of older adults, a big issue for so many families. This is the exclusive focus of the John A. Hartford Foundation, and you will hear from their president, Dr. Terry Fulmer, who will speak about their three main areas of interest.
We have three areas of emphasis: age-friendly health systems, support for family caregivers, and improving serious illness, end-of-life care.
Mm-hmm.
Those three are intimately interwoven every single day.
Then I will be joined by Brandy McHale, the president of the City Foundation and the head of corporate citizenship for Citigroup.
In a company with 200,000 employees scattered at all four corners of the world, it's not always easy to determine what issues you should get involved in. And we're very careful and thoughtful about how we use our corporate voice. But our employees want to come to work every day and feel good that they're not only contributing to the financial bottom line, but that they want to see how the company is making a difference in the world.
She'll tell us of the importance of a company taking a stand. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 9th. A large swath of fraternities will no longer allow hard liquor in chapter houses or at parties in most circumstances, according to a new policy approved by the major national association for fraternities. Brad Pitt's housing nonprofit, Make It Right, is facing a lawsuit. Rotting structural issues and mold contamination are among the allegations surfacing from residents of New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, where Make It Right developed more than 100 houses after Hurricane Katrina. Fighting climate change could boost the global economy by $26 trillion, according to a recent report. Concerted efforts to stop climate change by 2030 would also create 65 million new jobs and stop 700,000 premature deaths. The prison population forecaster shows how adjusting what crimes we put people in jail for and for how long can lower the incarceration rate in each state. And finally, a new report from Cause and Social Influence Programs found the top issue for today's young Americans are civil rights and racial discrimination, gun safety, immigration, and climate change. Black Lives Matter was the top movement of interest. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Dr. Terry Fulmer of the John A. Hartford Foundation right after this.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change when she found Year Up. Like many in her community, she was smart and talented, but didn't have the same opportunities as others. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and experience, entering the healthcare IT field upon graduation. Year Up is a transformative opportunity for motivated young adults and companies looking for talent. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
The number of Americans over 65 years of age has jumped from 35 million at the turn of the century to 50 million today. And in about 20 years, there will be more people over 65 than under 18 in America. Make no mistake about it, America is getting older. And one institution that is dedicated to improving the care of older adults is the John A. Hartford Foundation. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their president, Dr. Terry Fulmer. Good evening, Terry, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here and to talk with you about our foundation.
Well, let's talk about your foundation and its history. You were founded back in 1929, the year of the stock market crash. Share with us some of that history.
It's a wonderful history. John and George Hartford made their money from the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, so A&P grocery stores. They were early leaders in that organization. And at one point, they had 15,000 stores in this country. And they figured out early on how to reduce the price of food. And that actually brought a Sherman Antitrust Act against them. And today, of course, we think about Walmart and by comparison. Having said that, these were two visionary, very brilliant men who also were very committed to the well-being of the country. And they started their foundation in 1929, and their mission was to do the greatest good for the most people.
Mm-hmm.
And so early on in the foundation, the work was related to things like pacemakers, renal dialysis, biomedical research. And then the NIH was founded, and Medicare and Medicaid came into play, and they adjusted and began to do more policy work, a little more work related to the way in which we use technology, and even then there was technology. And then in the 80s, early 80s, shifted to aging.
Yeah.
And so since that time, we've focused solely on improving care for older adults.
Yep, and you have helped build the workforce in geriatric medicine. You know, before we get into some of the programs that you help support, let's talk about aging in broad terms. And we are in a society that's somewhat obsessed with remaining useful. But as a result of that, there's been this negative lens that we view aging through. What are some of the problems that are caused by this mindset?
There are several, and I would start by saying the greatest success story of the 20th century is longevity.
Mm-hmm.
We put all our energy, time, and talent into figuring out how to extend our life longevity, and in fact, what happened is the outcome, that is, there are a lot of older people. Why are we surprised? This is hilarious to me. We've known this as the boomers started aging. So the first thing is that we've intentionally worked hard to improve the length of time that people would live, and we've succeeded. So now what we have to do is build on the quality of life for older people. So how did we get in this mindset? That's a great question, and some would blame it on the boomers and say that, you know, we started early with Clairol and making sure that our hair never turned gray and staying physically fit and seeing you can do it and really making it almost a personal mission to say if you begin to look as if you're aging, you're failing.
Yeah.
And so
all kinds of creams for wrinkles and things of that nature.
Multi-billion dollar industry, maybe trillion, I don't know. And my friends in dermatology tell me it's a waste of our money, but we buy them. I buy them. So I think that we have to do some really substantial thinking about this and also think about how to take advantage of this social construct called aging, which we've created instead of thinking about function and capacity.
Well, you have teamed up with the Framework Institute and others to reframe aging. So how are you going to go about doing that?
Yeah, so we're very lucky to work with the Frameworks people, and Nat and his team are remarkable. The whole premise is that we need to think about the positivity of longevity and aging. And so they've done a very nice job thinking about simple things like what do older people like to be called? They do not like to be called seniors.
Mm.
They do not like to be referred to as a silver tsunami or a crisis. They are not a crisis. They are a fact of life, an important fabric of our society. And so Frameworks has done a remarkable job helping us think about how to turn that tide. Now, those of us in academics and healthcare and literature are following that but the basic person on the street is not. I think that we'll know things are changing when we see it more in the media. I think we do see some positive things in the media when you see anchors who are older women, for example, which wouldn't have happened.
Not at all.
Yeah, so this is an important Judy Woodruff, for example. You know, what a pioneer and, you know, just a stalwart in the industry.
Yeah. And they also are thinking about aging as a process of gaining momentum. Would that
yes.
be correct?
Yes, it is. And that gaining momentum and thinking about how with aging comes wisdom, maturity, reflection, and a capacity to really be a valuable player in whatever sphere you happen to be engaged in. So think about the fact that the Veterans Administration anticipates that they will have half their nurses of retirement age in the next 10 years. That's a serious issue unless you say, well, why are they retiring? Who should we retain? How should we think about this differently? Because there's this artificial construct called 65 that is creating an unnecessary crisis.
Yeah.
That's what we have to reframe.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Does anybody ever think of themselves as old? For instance, when I was younger, I would look at a certain age and I'd say, that's old. Or I might say, that's really, really old. But once you get there, it doesn't seem old at all. As a matter of fact, it's people maybe 15 years older than you. Mm-hmm. Now, that seems old. Mm-hmm. Am I alone or are most people like that?
So if we take it from our own lens, we do tend to compare ourselves with others and benchmark against those people who are older than we are. As a nurse, I think about it in terms of function and quality of life and how one feels. So people who have perhaps diabetes, arthritis, a number of chronic diseases that slow them down and don't feel well, they feel older.
Okay.
Now, if you happen to be one of the people who has, and some people call it age successfully, then you're going to be more robust and not think of yourself in that same frame.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to some of their major focus areas. And I know you're very excited at the progress that has been made in creating age-friendly health systems. And you have a very simple framework that you can explain this. That's the four M's of age-friendly health systems. What are those four M's, Terry?
Thank you for asking. We are passionate about this project. Our four M's are, number one, what matters to the person, medication, mentation, mobility. They can be in any order except the first one has to come first. What matters? Mentation, medication, mobility. So when one thinks about growing older, what are some of the things that are so prevalent? Falling, medication side effects, thinking about depression. If you get that 4M bundle right, you get the next exponential number correct as well, because you're thinking about the way to take care of an older adult. And certainly you start with what matters to you. And you'll hear people say, I really want to get to my granddaughter's wedding, or I've got one last trip to, you know, the Alps that I really want to make sure happens. So what matters is very important. For example, if someone said to you, you know I need to have my hip replaced, but I can't do that now because an astute care team, clinical care team, will listen to that.
Yeah.
Instead of pushing and saying you really need the surgery. So that's what we're talking about. But if I zoom my lens out with you for a moment, let's think about the age-friendly health system paradigm. Where did that come from? Well, John Beard and Alex Kalachi, the World Health Organization, in 2008 started talking about age-friendly cities, age-friendly communities. And so as I thought about my presidency at the foundation and what I wanted to lead with, I wanted to think about that framework and the health system as a continuum, so age-friendly health systems. Why? Because we do not have any. They don't exist currently, but we're working on it with our 4Ms.
You're making progress.
Yes, we are, and I want to really give a shout-out to IHI, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Boston, Massachusetts, where Derek Feely's president, Kater Mate is our PI, and they are relentless about improving quality, and we've got them snagged on aging.
There you go. A second area is family caregiving.
Right.
There are some, 18 million people in the U.S. are doing this on a regular basis, and many of them are providing dementia care at home, and that's a number that's only going to grow. What is the foundation doing to address this issue and help lift some of the burden off these family caretakers?
Right. So as you're indicating, we have three areas of emphasis: age-friendly health systems, support for family caregivers, and improving serious illness end-of-life care.
Mm-hmm.
Those three are intimately interwoven every single day.
Yeah.
So think about family caregivers and your point about 18 million. The AARP would say there are 40 million. Our study that the foundation helped fund at the Institute of Medicine said 18 million. But these family caregivers have a second shift, a third shift in their life. So they might go to their work, they come home, and they have a frail older person in their life who needs care. As you point out, they may have about 8 million people have dementia, mm-hmm. and that is exhausting and debilitating. So what are the supports we need to put in place to make sure that those family caregivers can do their work successfully and not be put in a position where they are doomed to fail?
What are some of those supports?
Some of the supports include the following. That is respite care, mm-hmm. and that means making sure that the older person has a place where they could go while the caregiver took a nap or did the grocery shopping alone, for example. Additionally, we think about ways in which the older person gets instruction around common problems they might encounter so that they can anticipate it and have the support around them. What am I talking about? When you're taking care of a person with dementia, one of the things that might happen is they might have difficulty going to the bathroom by themselves. Mm-hmm. This can be shocking to people. So how do we tell them in advance that this could happen, and what are some of the ways that you could create a better environment in anticipation?
Yeah.
So those are very concrete examples. And we need to be paying close attention to avoid elder abuse and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
In our experience, about 4% of older adults are known to be victims of elder mistreatment. Elder mistreatment is the outcome of abuse, neglect, exploitation, abandonment. So of those four categories, neglect is by far the most prevalent. That can be unintentional, but all the same, you might have a person who comes in severely dehydrated or with a pressure wound on their skin that's from that process. So helping a family caregiver, giving them support they need so that a person doesn't get in a state of neglect, is essential.
Yeah, and I think a lot of elder mistreatment in this country is just not reported to authorities. We kind of look at it as a private issue the way we once looked at domestic violence, but that certainly is not the case.
You're exactly right, and that's why our foundation made a grant to EDC, Education Development Center, in Newton, Massachusetts, where they have convened the nation's top researchers and clinicians in the field of elder mistreatment to form a collaboratory so that low-resource institutions can have the same quality of screening and referral as the places that have a lot of resources, like a Mount Sinai or a Cornell or a Mass General. So we want to make sure that every emergency room in the country has the requisite knowledge and skills and support to make sure that they can screen and refer.
Great. Let me ask you about elder orphans. I think about 23% of boomers will eventually be without family caregivers. I mean, how do you plan for that?
Right. So this is a natural experiment occurring. And what we know is that we can anticipate, but it's not clear what that scenario will look like. Here's an example of what it could look like. Robotics.
Mm-hmm.
So Japan is way ahead of us in thinking about the way that we need to use robots to perhaps be the eyes and ears for us when it comes to helping older people. We also know that they're making some progress in technology around type of robotics that can move a person safely,
mm-hmm.
the exoskeletons that are going on. And I'm very impressed by my friend Joe Coughlin at the MIT Age Lab,
yeah.
who has thought a lot about this. And he just wrote a book called The Longevity Economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give a shameless plug for that book because it's wonderful. And it really talks about how age is a social construct and how we need to be thinking about how technology will be assistive for us as we move into the boomer aging years.
You know, you touched on your third focus area a moment ago, and that's serious illness and end of life. And we didn't have many discussions about that even 10 years ago.
Exactly.
What are some of the things that people are talking about in that regard today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the best way to describe it and the way that it has surfaced so dramatically, really, is through the lens, again, of baby boomers. All of a sudden, they have seen what their parents have gone through, and they don't want it. They don't want it for their parents, and they don't want it for themselves. So suffering at the end of life is something that no one wants. But if you are not sure and you get sucked into our healthcare system with a 911 call, you will have tube strips and drains. You will likely end up in an intensive care unit if you have heart failure, if you have terrible pulmonary problems. And it begins a spiral that's very challenging and very difficult. So what we're trying to do now is start the conversation, as Ellen Goodman says, the conversation project, early at your dinner table, saying, when I'm there, these are the things that I would want you to do. These are the things I would not want you to do. Some people equate this to death panels, and we heard that in the news. Yeah. This is exactly not that.
Mm-hmm.
It is about pre-planning what you anticipate you will want at the end of life during serious illness. This is not hospice.
Mm-hmm.
This is serious illness. So if you have cancer, and you might, it's a chronic disease now. And you may live many years with that, and there will be times when you have peaks and valleys in your health. And so how do you want to move through that care is what we're trying to get people to talk about. And the Center for Advancement of Palliative Care at Mount Sinai, led by Dr. Diane Meyer, does a great job in helping people think about palliation, which is how we address symptoms and we manage symptoms and keep people at the highest quality of life they can have, even in light of terminal illness.
Yeah, and I even noted recently in both the case of Barbara Bush and John McCain, the news reported that they do not want any more care and have stopped it. And maybe that's happened before, but I don't remember hearing that on the news the way I have in the last couple months. There are about 4 million older people who have trouble getting to a doctor office or a clinic. So home-based primary care certainly would be a very nice thing to have if available. How available is it currently?
Well, it's not available enough, and so you're making a great point. There are programs that have been quite promising, home docs, for example, and also hospital at home. Bruce Leff, Al Sue, both prominent geriatricians in this country, demonstrating that you can have care that is just as successful, the outcomes just as positive, and yet have cost savings in light of what matters to the older person, staying at home.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is they want to stay home. I've never heard a person say, let me put it this way, once in a million I hear a person say, please, I'd really like to go to a long-term care facility.
Yeah.
That isn't what we talk about.
Not at all.
Even though those long-term care facilities can be quite remarkable in their quality and in what they can offer some older people. But the hospital at home, home docs, is coming back. And that really takes us back to the 1940s, 1950s.
Yeah.
And again, another book that I think is so instructive is by David Rothman, and it's called Strangers at the Bedside.
Mm-hmm.
And those strangers are accountants and lawyers, and how the one-to-one conversation between a nurse and a patient or a physician and a patient have become we've lost the privacy around that narrative. And so I think that fast forward, your important point is that people want to stay at home and we need to get that care there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a scourge to our nation, and that is the opioid crisis.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of news coverage of it lately, but generally speaking, it seems to be focused on the relatively young people in their 20s or 30s, maybe even their 40s. How significant is this epidemic among older Americans, those 65 and above, for instance?
Thank you for asking that. We're just beginning to understand the true depth and crisis of the opioid experience in older adults. Older adults see multiple specialists. They might get some Percodan from one physician for one type of pain, or a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant. And then they may end up with multiple opioids from a number of different specialists, and people aren't really aware of or cross-checking all the different interactions by the time the person's addicted. Now, the other side of the coin is that older people will sometimes say, I don't want to be addicted. Don't give me that medication, so they may suffer needlessly. I think that what happened over the past 10 years is that we convinced everybody that pain was the fifth vital sign. And that was what we were talking about in clinical care, that no one should suffer, no one should have pain. So we were very liberal in our use of opioids. And now we need to follow through and see who's addicted, who needs help, who needs to make sure that they are no longer on these medications. So the notion of deprescribing is one that's very popular right now, and I think it's important.
Yeah, it's a good thing, no question about it. Let's take a look at your organization, Terry, itself, and what makes the corporate culture of the John A. Hartford Foundation unique and distinctive, and is there any one thing you do to help shape and influence that culture?
That's a great question. What's special about our corporate culture is that everybody comes to work every day with the same passion, that is improving care for older adults. And it transcends to our CFO, our tech people. They listen, they participate in our conversations because everybody's affected.
Everybody's connected to the mission.
Everybody is. Everybody has an older relative, friend, family member. And so it's personal. So I'd say that makes us special. It's very, very personal every day. We're not diffuse. We focus on better care for older adults. And so there's no question. If you come into our office, our walls are covered with pictures of wonderful older people. And one of the pictures, you'll get a kick out of this, I put up was a picture of Henry Kissinger. And now, Henry Kissinger's in his 90s.
Saw him at McCain's funeral the other day.
Exactly. Looks great.
Yeah,
nobody says.
Looks the same.
Exactly.
I don't know if it's great,
exactly.
But it's the same.
And here's the comedy. When young people come in the office, I'll say, "Who's that?" And they say, "I don't know." So I think that makes us all humble. But we live it. We think about it. We have our mission painted on the wall. I borrowed that from IHI, where they do that. And it really, every day you walk in, you say, "That's why we're here. We're going to improve care for older adults," and I love it.
Let me close with this. There's often discussion and debate on whether more of society's limited resources should be directed to the elderly or to the very young. And that debate is made even more complex because the predominant racial and ethnic makeup of each population. How do you think about this? How do you think this nation needs to think about this?
So this is not a zero-sum game. And what we don't want is intergenerational warfare.
Right.
Where if you get this, I don't get that. So I think we have to look at this holistically. It's in the best interest of our country that everybody stays healthy. So prevention, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is doing a very nice job thinking about a culture of health, and that this is not us versus them. This is all in for the well-being of our nation. And I will say that at our foundation, we hope that we can engage dozens more foundations in the work of better care for older people. There are not that many foundations that really focus on aging,
right.
But I do believe that's changing because everybody's looking in the mirror. So that's really important. And I think that we're very impressed with the way in which we can partner with others to get this where we want it, which is better care, better lives for older people.
Well, Dr. Terry Fulmer, the president of the John A. Hartford Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Your website is johnahartford.org. What information there will visitors find to be useful?
I think they'll find our priority areas. They'll find links to wonderful instructional materials. They'll see videos that help them think about what we think about. And if they don't find that, they should call me. And we welcome their call.
I bet you do. Well, thanks, Terry. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity today.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org. With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Financial institutions play a particularly important role in society. Their ability to leverage capital, both in the country where they're based and around the world, can help accelerate real and lasting change. That also holds true for their philanthropy and the investments they make in purpose-driven businesses. And it's a pleasure to have with us someone who plays a pivotal role in one of the most influential and significant of these financial institutions. She is Brandy McHale, the president of the Citi Foundation and the head of corporate citizenship at Citigroup. Good evening, Brandy, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Boy, it sounds like just one of those jobs would be more than enough for me. But it's interesting that you carry both titles. So let's begin with that. How does the mission and purpose of the Citi Foundation intersect, overlap, reinforce what's going on at Citigroup to be a good corporate citizen?
So I think this is an incredibly innovative and interesting time to be in a role like this in a private sector company. I was named the president of the Citi Foundation in 2015, and along with it came this title to be the head of corporate citizenship. Now, I will tell you, I started as a summer intern in the Citi Foundation in 1991, and I never dreamed that one day I would actually be the president, but here I am. And the interesting thing about that is I got the job I always wanted, and just at that time I began to recognize that if we were really going to drive and maximize positive social impact, our philanthropy was important, but really what was going to make the difference was how we leveraged the additional resources of our company. What we do best is to be a bank. And so how do we leverage all the assets of this global financial institution to drive economic progress? The philanthropy is important, and I view it almost like the icing on the cake. And so in this role, I both work across our businesses to both catalyze and capture how we are making a positive impact and try to incent them to do more. And then we use our philanthropy to really spark innovative ideas.
Yeah, they really mutually reinforce one another. How does an international financial institution make these kinds of decisions and determinations? I mean, what your philanthropic focus is going to be, what your signature programs are, and I'm sure you need to listen and provide some autonomy to all your offices throughout the world. How do you bring all that together to decide what you're going to do?
I think that you've hit on one of the hidden challenges in a role like this, which is there are many good things that you can fund. There are many good initiatives that you can launch. But how do you launch things that are both good for the world and good for the company? And so we really sat back and said, what matters to our employees? What matters to our clients? What challenges are they facing? What matters to the public officials and the citizens and the communities that we work with? And so taking all of those things into account and looking overall at the mission of Citigroup, and our mission is to drive economic progress, we said, how do we then align our philanthropy and our citizenship initiatives with that overall mission? It's not easy. You can't be everything to everyone, but I do think that our focus in particular on investing in young people and helping to drive economic opportunity for them is one that is universal around the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that one then. And you have made a significant commitment to reduce youth unemployment. And you have a number of programs in that area. But Pathways to Progress, that initiative is a big one. You announced a $100 million commitment just last year over the next 3 years. Tell me what you're doing there.
Sure. Well, we actually started in 2014 with a U.S. commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, the unemployment rate was high. The nature of the jobs available were changing. And young people, their unemployment rates were continuing to skyrocket. And so when we first began this pilot in 2014, it was $50 million here in the U.S. across 10 cities. Then the economy began to change.
Mm-hmm.
And the global challenge of youth unemployment is continuing to rise. In many countries, youth unemployment levels are three times that of adults. And so this was a persistent challenge. We completed the U.S. pilot and then doubled down and made this global commitment in 2017. And we're trying to do a few things through this initiative. One is to connect young people actually to jobs and to internships that are going to give them real life experience.
Mm-hmm.
Two is to connect them to mentors and to help them make connections and build their own networks that are so critical to getting jobs. And three, the piece that I find most personally inspiring is really helping young people to see themselves as an asset in their community and to give back and to build the problem-solving skills that they're going to need in the workplace through community service and volunteerism.
And speaking about that mentoring, this is far more than just a financial commitment. You're mobilizing 10,000 volunteers as part of this.
Yes.
What are they going to be doing along with that mentoring, and what organizations are they working through?
So I think that this is the secret ingredient in this whole program. You know, Pathways to Progress, your big numbers, $100 million over 3 years, reach 500,000 young people
mm-hmm.
around the world. But this addition of committing that we will engage 10,000 of our employees to roll up their sleeves and get directly involved with a young person, I think that's what actually makes the difference. And so they're doing a variety of things. We have employees that have committed through programs such as iMentor here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
to mentor a young person for over a 3 to 4 year period to establish a long-term relationship with a young person. We have a partnerships with Nifty and JA.
Mm-hmm.
There, the engagement is to serve as a judge and a coach and help young people as they develop their business ideas. We know that not every young person is going to go on to be a business owner, but helping them to cultivate that entrepreneurial mindset and the ability to sell themselves and their ideas is so important. And our employees play an important role in giving them that feedback and that guidance. And then we have employees that are doing more limited engagements with young people. One of my favorite programs that we're funding is the National Association of Urban Debate Leagues.
Uh-huh.
Helping young people, again, to stand up, to have strength and find their voice. And our employees are working as, again, judges and coaches in that program as well.
Yeah, and you just didn't dive into this issue. You've really studied it a lot. And part of that is that you did this extensive survey with ISPOS to find out what young people around the world are thinking. Are they optimistic despite some of these high unemployment rates? And what are some of the other particular interesting findings you had from that study?
So more than three quarters of the young people that we surveyed, we found, are optimistic about their economic future. But when you unpack that data, because we did do a multi-country survey, we covered 40 countries,
mm-hmm.
you discover some very interesting differences. And actually, levels of optimism are higher in developing contexts than in developed countries.
Interesting.
Yes. And as we began to unpack that data, I think what we found is that when young people see growth happening around them, they have a sense that growth is inclusive and there's a sense of excitement and building towards the future. Young people that were coming from countries that had experienced an economic downturn were less optimistic about their own future prospects. But I think overall, we're in an exciting time where technology is making the world a smaller place. Information is more readily available. But universally, the other finding that really stood out for me was the importance of mentors and networks.
Mm-hmm.
These young people recognize that it's not just about what you know, but who you know. And I think one of the universal features of all the programs that we fund through Pathways to Progress is really understanding the power of a caring adult in the life of a young person. And sometimes it's about just sharing the unspoken sort of secret facts.
You're absolutely right.
You know, how do you show up in the workplace? Mm-hmm. What do you do when you have a problem? Who do you call? And when you're the first person in your family that's taking on some of these roles, these mentors play a very, very powerful role.
Yeah, I think with all young people, some soft skills will come in very handy. You know, a lot of time is spent on tablets and on other devices, so knowing how to look somebody in the eye and use a telephone and shake somebody's hand. It's also interesting what you talked about in terms of the developing world versus the developed world. It just seems that people's mindset and their sense of optimism has nothing to do with where they are absolutely. It's the direction in which they're headed. And in those developing countries, as you say, that direction, even if it's absolutely a lot less, it's pointing in a better direction, so that optimism will come. You know, about half of the world's population live in urban areas, about 55%, and that's going to be like 70% by 2050. And in the U.S. today, it's about 80%. So it only makes sense that sustainable cities would be another area of focus for you guys. One of your partners has been Living Cities, and you launched with them a number of years ago the City Accelerator Initiative. Tell us about that.
Well, you're absolutely right. The urbanization trend is continuing, and it's growing, and we don't see it abating. And so, you know, you think back 20, 30, 40 years ago, cities were places that residents were fleeing, like mm-hmm. the middle class were fleeing. You think about now what's happened from a development and growth standpoint, and cities now are the epicenter of economic growth and development.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a big shift, particularly here in the U.S., in how we view cities. They're not places to flee. But that development has not always meant economic opportunity for everyone. And unfortunately, our lowest income residents in cities may not be benefiting from that development and growth. And you can see it in places, even look at the high cost of housing in places such as the Bay Area. Jobs are growing faster than they can get people there, but people can't afford to live there. That's just one example. You have cities also that are experiencing the impacts of social challenges. You have people returning from prison that need to be reintegrated back into communities. So a host of challenges exist, but there are a lot of really positive assets as well. And that is really what the City Accelerator is about, is to say, how do we infuse and influence the positive development activity to ensure that there's an intentional focus on low-income communities and communities of color so everybody can benefit from this growth.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to be the incoming chair at Living Cities, right?
Yes, I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's a big assignment.
Thank you. And I think the other piece about Living Cities and the City Accelerator work that was really groundbreaking when we began, and I think now is becoming a trend in philanthropy, is seeing municipalities as agents of change.
Mm.
That funding community-based organizations, that's an incredibly important piece of the development puzzle, but municipalities really control a level of resources and touch our lives in so many ways. And so how do we support the municipalities to be change agents themselves and leverage mayors and influence their agendas? And funding through City Accelerator, we're actually making these small grants to cities directly so that they have resources. They don't have to use public funds to test and try some new things. But if we're successful, we hope that we'll infuse this culture of inclusivity and innovation throughout the municipality.
Absolutely. We just had Jim Anderson, who's the head of government innovation for Bloomberg Philanthropies, on the show a couple weeks ago, and he would certainly echo what you just said. Final area of focus is financial inclusion. And it's hard for me to believe, Brandy, sometimes that 2 billion people are currently locked out of any form of the financial system around the world. The world, which only has 7 billion people, and you got another 2 billion who are sort of in and out of that formal and informal economy. What are the foundation's efforts regarding this?
Well, we've had a long history in the financial inclusion space, and actually one of our core pillars, we actually started back in the 1970s funding microfinance institutions, and we're very proud of the history that we've played in helping to grow the microfinance sector, which then evolved into the financial inclusion sector, mm-hmm. looking more broadly, not just at how do you make small loans to individuals so they can start enterprises and increase their income. But again, as you've said, how do you connect them to the broader financial system so that they have their funds are safe, they have an ability to save, they have an ability to borrow, and they really is a catalyst for allowing them to think about their financial future. For us, the interesting piece of this is, and this is how I view success with philanthropy. If we're successful, we will actually put ourselves out of business from a philanthropic standpoint.
Yeah.
We want to do is to test ideas and in our case really demonstrate that there's a potential market opportunity so you can bring ideas to scale.
Mm-hmm.
And at Citi, we've actually moved our work in financial inclusion primarily from the foundation. We've created a dedicated inclusive finance business. And what is unique about it is we may not be directly banking those 2 billion individuals, but we are banking the institutions that are in place to serve them. And so I view the financial inclusion work as we help to bring this into the financial system sector. So what's successful is that this is no longer just about philanthropy, but we've actually figured out how to make the market work for people that are left out of the market system.
Right. There are 2 billion potential customers as well, you know, which is fabulous. Let me ask you to put on your other hat for a minute, and that's the head of corporate citizenship for Citigroup. And let's start with climate change. I would think that as a financial institution, you're probably leveraging some capital somewhere in there. What is your work looking like?
So let me first say we're very proud to say that we are still in the there have been a lot of political discussions that have been happening and a lot of decisions that have been made from a policy standpoint about climate change here in the U.S. We believe the private sector has an incredibly important role in addressing what I think is one of the biggest challenges facing our planet and our communities today. For us, climate change isn't just about the environment broadly, but it's really about how people live. And there's a threat to the way we live in communities. There's a threat to our businesses. There's a threat to our clients and their ability to do business in the future. So we really see this as an economic issue as well as an environmental issue. We made a groundbreaking commitment in 2015 to lend, invest, and facilitate $100 billion in climate-positive activity. I'm very proud to say that we're ahead of schedule. It was a 10-year goal.
Yeah.
We are more than halfway through that goal, only 3 years in. And what's important about it is many of the deals that we're involved in, they're firsts. They're the first of their kind. We're working with our clients. We're working with public sector entities, with private sector clients to figure out how do they adapt what they do today to meet the demands that they need from an environmental standpoint tomorrow. And because many of these deals are a first of their kind, we're helping to create a climate change marketplace. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy.
No.
It's as much about capital as it is perception and risk. And we have the entire company working on all cylinders to identify those opportunities. And again, it's not just because we see this as a leadership area for ourselves, but this is really what our clients need. They need to figure out how to adapt and evolve their businesses and their organizations so that they reduce the risks that they're facing.
Which is also part of your job. You know, I think what's interesting about it is that I initially think of you as sort of an external spokesperson about Citi being a good corporate citizen. But when you stop and think about it, you really need to be an internal change agent because you have to change the way Citi does business to become a better and better citizen. That could be a tricky proposition. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, Citi is a company that's been around for more than 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a recognition at all levels of the company, from our board, our senior leadership, all the employees, that if we want to be around for another 200 years, it's really about responsible finance. And so I'm very lucky because I'm not a lone voice out there talking about how do we do things that drive social impact. That's actually embedded now in part of our mission. And again, we recognize it's about our own bottom line and sustainable future as much as it is about doing the right things for the world. But how do you get from a mission statement to the actually making things happen? And you're right. It's being an internal change agent and exciting people about the opportunity and the possibilities. And then it's also just as much about what are things that we're not going to do anymore. So while we have this industry-leading sustainable finance commitment, We also have made some changes to say there are things that we're not going to engage in anymore. An example of this is we passed a policy related to coal finance.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the largest sources of financing for coal companies around the world, if you think about all the countries you do business
right.
in.
No mas.
And we're working to help countries and our clients to transition to cleaner forms of energy.
Let me ask you about employee advocacy and some of the things that an individual's own company is doing. And a couple of examples have been in the news lately. Google employees obviously have been concerned about the censored version of its search engine for China that was being built in secret. I know that Salesforce employees signed a petition and took it to the CEO asking him to reexamine the contracts they have with U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency. It's very difficult for companies to sort of sit on the sidelines around a lot of these issues. We certainly have seen what Nike has done now with Colin Kaepernick. I'm not going to ask you to comment on any of those, but I know you've given this issue a lot of thought. Tell me what you're thinking about it has been.
I think one of the most important trends that we've seen in the corporate social responsibility space is the power of a company to use its corporate voice.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that comes in the form of signing on to something and standing up for something and having your CEO make a statement. Sometimes it comes in the form of your own policies and practices. In a company with 200,000 employees scattered at all four corners of the world, it's not always easy to determine what issues you should get involved in. And we're very careful and thoughtful about how we use our corporate voice. But our employees want to come to work every day and feel good that they're not only contributing to the financial bottom line, but that they want to see how the company is making a difference in the world. And so while they may not always agree sometimes with all of the positions that are taken or may not fully understand, they want to see that their company is engaged and listening and wants to have a seat at the table. An example I can give you, the most recent example of this, here in the U.S., we passed for the first time a U.S. commercial firearms policy that is focused on retail practices in the firearm space so that we are only going to do business with retailers who agree to only make firearm sales if a consumer has passed a background check,
mm-hmm.
that there are some restrictions in place for consumers under the age of 21. We want to see that they've had some form of firearm education and training, and that we won't do business with retailers who sell high-capacity magazines or bump stocks. This does not impact any individual consumer's ability to use a city credit card or product to make a legal firearms purchase at any retailer of their choice. But what we wanted to do was to use our influence and to support retailers, many of whom, including the country's largest retailer, who have already adopted these common sense sales practices.
Mm-hmm. Standing on the sidelines is no longer an option around a lot of these issues. You know, nonprofits are always being asked to make a case on how their organizations or programs are making a difference, the long-term impact that they're having on the people that they serve. And now funders are asking themselves the same question. How does a city foundation gauge the kind of social impact it is having? And you also look at the economic impact it is having for the company as well.
This is the question that I wake up to every morning and I go to sleep to every night. It really is, how do you
know? Glad I got you in the middle of the day.
How do you know that you're making a difference? And maybe I've rationalized it for myself to make it a little bit easier to sleep at night, but I think experience has shown me that being engaged and being involved and being part of the dialogue and saying these issues matter is just as important as what you're actually funding on the ground. So
mm-hmm.
I would say the first level of impact is it makes a statement that these things matter and being an advocate for these issue areas. The second piece is, I think making an impact as a funder is not just necessarily about, again, what you give, but how you give. One of the things we're very proud of at the City Foundation is we do not want to be in the business of torturing our grantees. Data is absolutely important, and we live in a data-informed society, but you can also go too far over the line. And what we want to do is make investments in our grantees so that they have an ability to be change agents and they have an ability to innovate. We don't want to be funding them just only to deliver services and report on those services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it seems that if you have confidence in an organization, enough confidence that you're going to fund them, then you should trust them to know what to do with that money. And so much of it changes in midstream when people have made these restricted program grants that many organizations are just stuck seeing them through because they have signed an agreement. So you've really moved a little bit more, it sounds like, to unrestricted giving.
We have. In fact, here in the U.S., we have invested to date $40 million in unrestricted giving. We have an initiative called Community Progress Makers.
Mm-hmm.
We did a six-city challenge to select 40 organizations to give to provide core unrestricted
support. We've had a number of them on the show. Hot Bread Kitchen,
yes.
List, a number of those.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think fundamentally what that reflects is what is at the core of our culture is a foundation, which is that we actually don't have the answers. I wish we did.
Yeah.
But the reality is that in the grantee-grantmaker relationship, there's also this sort of a power dynamic where there's an assumption, right, that the grantmaker has all the answers because they've got all of the resources. The reality is we don't have the answers. So mm-hmm. what we want to do is find people and visionary leaders that we believe in and give them flexible dollars and support their vision because they have the answers, they have the experience, they have the track record, and then hopefully work together to elevate their results to the next level.
Well, that's great to hear. It's amazing how a little humility really does go a long way, doesn't it? You know, we're pretty obsessed with workplace culture on the Business of Giving. Tell us about yours at the City Foundation, an interesting situation there in the middle of this capitalistic financial institution. And one thing that maybe you think makes it special and different from other financial institutions.
So a couple things. I think you've hit right the nail on the head about when you're in a corporate philanthropy role, you are sitting within a larger company.
Mm.
And so when I interview people and I say, why are you interested in this position? And they say, I'd like to dedicate my life to doing good in the world. I put them in the B pile immediately. It's not that those aren't important goals and important values to have, but what you really need to do is find that sweet spot. Say, how do we do things and design initiatives, again, that are good for the world and good for our company, good for our brand, good for our employees? So it takes a skill set where you need to be versatile and you need to be able to balance competing stakeholder interests. The second thing at the City Foundation that I think is really core to our culture is a willingness to try things, and sometimes they don't always work. And that has absolutely, you can see that mirrored in our approach with our grantees. Our work and our engagement with our grantees, nobody wants to see your grantees fail. We're also not going to spend our energy tracking, you know, if they fail. We're not going to penalize them. Actually, that's the whole point of philanthropy. Flexible dollars, you don't have to pay them back. So let's be innovative. Let's be entrepreneurial. And if it doesn't work, let's not throw good money at bad.
Mm-hmm.
Let's revisit what we do together. So a real willingness to course correct and to change direction if we need to, and a culture and an environment of collective learning together. And then the final piece would be to have some fun. I know that fun may seem a little light and fluffy here, but this is hard work.
Serious stuff.
It's very serious. But at the heart of all of these initiatives, it doesn't really matter what your focus area is, are people. You're really trying to influence the lives of people and help them to generate positive outcomes for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to be human yourself. And you have to be able to laugh. You have to be able to cry a little bit.
Even be a little irreverent at times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the final piece of our culture is that when you need to make that hard decision, we make it.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Brandy. Have you ever been able to quantify or measure in any way, and if not, maybe just anecdotally, the impact that all these initiatives have had on recruitment, have had on retention, have had on the overall pride and morale of the workforce at Citigroup?
Well, one of the things that we do that's unique at Citi and we run through our foundation work is we have an annual day of service called Global Community Day.
Mm-hmm.
This year we had more than 115,000 employee friends and family turn out to volunteer and to
Impressive.
Give back to communities. It's a big undertaking. It reflects over 500 events around the world. We're very, very proud of it. There is no other company that does something like this at this level and this scale. And I cite this because I think one of the areas of impact that we look to track is this issue of scale. You can do lots of things, and there are many good organizations doing good work, but how do we do some things at scale so we get attention, so we get people to see that these types of efforts, it's not just about giving back. I think one of the things that I'm most proud of at Citi is a recognition that this is also about investing in our company and about investing in our people. Our people feel so good. We do Voice of the Employees surveys. We know that this type of work matters to our employees. But I think we've hit a real turning point in a recognition we've built into our leadership standards and our performance review for our employees, what role they play in giving back to society, what type, and building that into, again, what type of leader they are. So there's lots of data out there, but I think we're on the cusp of this, and we're at a time where we're reinventing how we're looking at that work.
Well, Brandy McHale, the president of the Citi Foundation and the head of corporate citizenship at Citigroup, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. What's on that website of yours for people looking to find out more?
You can visit citigroup.com and go to our corporate citizenship page, where we have our annual report that details all the ways across our company we're making a positive social impact, both through our philanthropy and our core businesses, and by leveraging our employees. And for more real-time updates, I just encourage you, please follow me at Brandy McHale at Twitter. We're out there all the time showcasing our programs and our grantees and our ideas, and we'd love to have you be part of that conversation.
Well, thanks, Brandy. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guests will be Brandy McHale, the president of the Citibank Foundation, and Terry Fulmer, president of the John Harford Foundation, which is dedicated to improving the care of older adults. Thanks for listening. Have a great first week of September, and do come back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.